are interesting are people who are interested. Any person, for example, who is constantly thinking about all sorts of other things and other people and so on, because they're fascinating, becomes a fascinating person. So in other words, your engagement with the external world, the more you are involved, the more your personality is enriched.
Hello, listener. In this episode, I'm talking to a musical genius who is pioneering something called polytempos. Don't worry, we'll come back to that. Apologies for the sound quality on this one. It was recorded during lockdown V2, and I travelled to Eddie and we recorded it in the back of my camper van. So it was a bit echoey, and you can hear cars going past in the background, plus at one point it started to rain, and it's very audible. So you can look forward to listening out for all of that. Also, I put out some organic chocolates in a kilner jar, and if you listen very carefully, you'll hear a faint clicking sound quite frequently in the background. That's the sound of Eddie giving in to desire. In fact, a lot of the time, when he's talking, it's ever so slightly muffled because he's got a chocolate in his mouth. Our conversation touches on all sorts of interesting topics, and Eddie gives numerous recommendations for things, in quotes, you should listen to. I made a list of most of these in the show notes. I should explain that I didn't have a lot of time with Eddie, as he was practicing for an upcoming performance, so rather than get him to laboriously explain some subjects for you, I decided to edit in little nuggets of information afterwards. The flow is a little bit interrupted, but I think you'll like the kooky little interludes that I added. Enjoy!
So that's what it looks like if you go on my Instagram.
That is, yeah. How else would I? I don't have access to your account otherwise. That's just what you look like. I doubt anybody scrolls through it like that, realistically.
They don't.
No, you just a normal feed, or just you'll pop up in a mix of other things. But it works enough that I see you on there. I found out about you being interviewed by the Music is Medicine guy by your
Damien.
Instagram.
Yeah. Do you know Damien?
I don't know Damien.
He is the coolest guy.
Yeah, well, I watched the interview.
He's lovely. Really, really, like, heart of gold kind of bloke.
All right, there we go. Feel free to smash through those chocolates.
I'm trying to restrain myself, but I'm not doing very well.
No.
Because they're fucking yummy. They're really, really good chocolates.
You can keep the pot.
No, we'll get there. Let's just see how it goes. So, let's do it.
Okay. We're on. Yeah.
Are we recording? One, two.
That's it.
I'm cancerous. No. I'm gonna diss you, wouldn't want to answer this. If you responded back with a battle rap, I wrote for cannabis. Oh, that's I won't do that. Right, gone.
Welcome, Eddie. You're a multi-instrumentalist. You are pioneer of the polyrhythm. You're a musical Einstein. You're a whole bunch of things. And you're also my buddy. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Very kind of you to say all those things. I don't agree or disagree with any of those things, but...
All abundantly true.
Okay, well, thanks.
Yeah. So, we have to get this out of the way quickly, because, let's be honest, within a few months, and if not months, years, you'll be far too famous, and then you won't want to talk to people like me.
Well, to be honest, I would like to avoid personal fame as much as possible, whilst getting my music to have as wide a reach as possible. And there's a certain contradiction in there. I know it's not going to be possible to get my music all over the world without having a little bit of fame. But hopefully if we could keep a lid on that and not play too much into the whole kind of fame game circus, try and stay slightly back from it, that'd be nice.
You could go the Slipknot approach and wear one of those nail bomb masks.
I could do that. I probably won't do that.
Yeah, it's probably not the image you're looking for.
Yeah. Like. Also, I don't think that the kind of music that I'm making is the kind of thing that's going to be like super popular and famous. Because if you look on YouTube, for example, it's a great example. You could find like 5 or 6 videos of brilliant, genius musicians playing incredibly beautiful and wonderful music, and it's got like 3,000 views. Mm. And then you find some utter trash, which is so bad that you literally can't believe it, and it's got like 3 billion views. So that's the way of the world right now. So I don't think I'm in danger of becoming super famous anytime soon with the kind of music that I'm doing.
No, that is a sad state of the world, and very true. So for people who don't know what you do, you know, the main thing, well, not I wouldn't say the main thing, but you are on the edge of being famous, if not famous in my mind,
for polyrhythms or polytempos, as you call it now.
Yeah, I've started to call it polytempos rather than polyrhythms, is what I said originally, because polyrhythms carries with it a lot of baggage from the past that I don't intend. So, and also it kind of implies, polyrhythms kind of implies that there's one tempo and there's different rhythms going on within that one tempo. But I really want to get at the idea that there are multiple tempos. Mm. And I'm trying to kind of like make that clear in the music. So it's not, so it doesn't feel like there's just this multiple rhythms in one, making one tempo, but it's literally multiple tempos doing different things that sound like they're in different worlds that kind of are interacting in some quite hard to discern sort of way.
Okay, so just in case people haven't heard of it, I'm going to play a little clip from you at TEDx Reading describing it in your own words, because okay, it's you.
As long as you don't play the playing from the TEDx, because the playing was shoddy, that TEDx thing. I can't watch that TEDx thing. I just like, it hurts me inside to listen to the playing. Okay. But I do basically agree with everything that I said.
So okay.
The talking's fine.
Tiny confession here. I did exactly what Eddie asked me not to do and used the TEDx recording. So it doesn't really matter, because Eddie's never going to listen to this. And as long as you don't tell him, I won't tell him. All right? Great.
What you heard there was a little example of polyrhythmic music. Just a short example. Polyrhythmic music is music where there are multiple parts or melodic lines moving at different speeds relative to each other. So it all sounds very complicated, but let's break it down and make it very simple. To start off with, we've got one part moving at two beats in a bar, the speed of two. One, two, one, two. What could be simpler? Two. And over the top of that, I'm going to have another part moving in three beats in a bar. Sounds like this. One, two, three, one, two, three. Okay, now over the top of that, we're going to have another part moving in five beats in a bar, the speed of five. Back to three over two. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, one, two. Right. Okay, now in the right hand, I'm going to have a part moving in seven beats per bar. Okay, so now we're going to bring the five in and then the seven over the top. So 2 over 3, over 5, over 7. Okay. So here's the 5. And the 7. Thank you. So this is polyrhythm. So let's look at now polyphasing, a slightly different idea. If my speed of 5, for example, has got 4 notes in its phrase, 1, 2, 3, 4, and by playing at the speed of 5, the 1 will phase round and land on a different note each time. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So we say the 5 is phasing in 4. Similarly, I could have my 3, the old 3 over the 2 down here, phasing in 4. So there's 4 notes in the phrase. It's moving at the speed of 3, 4 notes in the phrase. It's not as complicated as it sounds. Okay, now, over the top of this 3, phasing in 4, I'm going to bring in a 5, phasing in 3. Sounds like this. Okay. And now, a 7, phasing in 5. So it's at the speed of 7, but there's 5 notes in a phase. So. And now we'll try them all together. So that's just a straight 2 with a 3 phasing in 4 and a 5 phasing in 3 and a 7 phasing in 5. Something like this. Thank you very much. Okay, let's look at another example, just to make this point clear. Another example. So we've got, in the left hand, I'm moving at the speed of 3 here. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But as you might notice, there are 5 notes there. So the 3 is phasing in 5. Again, the top, I'm going to bring in a 7, phasing in 4. Sounds like this. And then in the middle, going to bring a 5 in. Keep the examples short, keep your attention. So does it have to be so complicated, you might ask? Does it have to be so complicated? No, it doesn't. Let's take a really simple riff here, a little simple idea. 1, 2, 3, 4. Right, well, that's simple, isn't it? 1, 2, 3, 4. And same thing left hand. 1, 2, 3, 4. And if I play those together without any polyrhythm, without any phasing, it just sounds like this. You may or may not want to listen to that. But if I play the right hand at a speed of 5, relative to the left hand being a speed of 3, the very same thing sounds a lot more interesting. Thank you. So how far can it be taken? How far can you take this concept? There's no theoretical limit to it, but the furthest I've been able to take it is 25 over 15 over 12 over 16 over 20. Now, some people might be thinking, that sounds impossibly difficult. There must be a trick. And there is sort of a trick. So I'm going to try and explain that to you now. In the right hand, I'm going to start with a 5, going like this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Again, we're putting it in just simple scales, so it's easy to hear. Against a 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, over a 3. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. So that sounds like this. In the left hand, we're going to take a 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Over a 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2. Which sounds like this. Okay. Now the trick is that the 5, remember this 5 at the top in the left hand, that's a 5 relative to the 4 and the 3 in the left hand, is going to be a 4 relative to the 5 and the 3 in the left hand. Okay. Maybe it'd be better if I just played it. So this is 25 over 50 over 15 over 12 over 16 over 20. That's even harder to play than it is to say.
Lovely jubbly. So now that you're all experts in polyrhythm or polytempo, let's go back to me and Eddie in the van.
So, how did you come to it?
Okay, so I came to it when I first went to a medicine ceremony and I had an amazing experience listening to Ravi play, actually. Ravi play electric kora. And also I heard the Bwiti music for the first time.
Hi. Interrupting me again. So, just a quick explanation. The Bwiti music is ceremonial music from Gabon. It typically, although not always, accompanies the ingestion of a psychedelic plant called iboga. And it sounds a little something like this. Thank you. To me and Eddie in the van.
And also I heard the Bwiti music for the first time, and both of those things kind of blew me away to a massive extent. And within the evening I kind of had a new vision of music, and it's difficult to really describe it, you know, verbally, but the best I could say was that it was a sort of multi-dimensional music. I mean, I'm sure that you know what I'm talking about with some of the medicine experiences. It's as if you're experiencing some other dimension or multiple dimensions at the same time. It's impossible to describe. And whenever he's talking about multiple dimensions, it sounds pretty lame because the kind of term dimension has been so overused in trying to describe. So it's a whole other dimension, man. Yes. But I don't have any better language to use than other dimensions. So I'm sort of stuck with that word, annoying, overused word dimension. But I kind of had the experience of multi-dimensional music.
Yeah.
And coming back from that ceremony, I then started to try and put together the theory and the technique to be able to sort of realise that. Because the idea of the multi-tempo music came in an instant, but the practicalities of it took a really long time to work out how it can be possible. Yeah. You just say, if you have the idea, if you envision in your mind, say, 3 or 4 speeds happening, you then think, okay, how can I physically do that? You've got to break it down to its constituent bits and go right back down to the basics and build up from there. So it's a real exciting kind of exploration of the possibilities of multi-tempo.
And who do you go to at this point? You can go to anybody to go and teach you piano or go and teach you something. Where do you then start to go and be like...
Well, I mean, as far as the multi-tempo thing goes, it's difficult to find someone to learn from. Because I don't think haven't found anybody else doing this kind of thing. But what I can learn from is various interesting rhythmic styles. For example, like you listen to Meshuggah, for example, the metal band. Mm. Now, they're not doing the same thing as me, but they're doing something very rhythmically interesting. So by listening to that, I'm getting different kind of rhythmical influence. And then I listen to the Bwiti music. Again, that's very different from what I'm doing, but it's got lots of new ideas in it. And then I might listen to some Bartok, for example, like a 20th century Hungarian composer, Bartok. It's very percussive, very interesting, quirky music. And I learned something from that. So I'm kind of constantly learning from lots of different genres, particularly electronica, jazz and metal, but also world music and also 20th century classical music. And I sort of get inspired all kinds of different kind of ways from the different sort of rhythmic idiosyncrasies of those styles.
We touched a little bit on the medicine, and we can cut this bit of the conversation out later if you like.
Well, it depends who's going to hear this.
Yeah. Well, probably not very many people to start with, to be honest, Eddie. How far are you happy to go in talking about that?
Maybe let's just not mention any particular names.
Okay. We could say
plant medicines.
We could just leave it at plant medicines.
Because plant medicines could be lavender, couldn't it?
It could be anything.
Maybe I picked a sprig of lavender, right, from my grandma's garden and smelt it, felt very chilled out and had a vision of multidimensional music. Yeah, there's... That's perfectly possible and plausible.
Absolutely.
So let's just leave it open to the imagination.
We can leave it open to the imagination, totally. So you're going on this journey and you're essentially finding your own way in this place, which is mega. In terms of where you get your music from, and I've talked to you about this in the past or been conversations around people, but the idea that you don't come up with the songs, and the songs are delivered to you, so they're yeah. coming from somewhere else.
So I guess a good analogy would be that I feel like in my practice, I'm trying to put the tools in place so that when the inspiration comes, I've got the tools to express it. Mm. You know, it's, or you could think of it like, I guess digging a canal isn't the best example because, you know, you might say, oh, I'm digging canals and waiting for the water to come and rush through, but it's not really like that because if I had canals, that'd be a set direction for the water to go, and it actually goes freely if you've got technique there. But what I find is the way that my progress happens is that I'm at the piano and I've got a particular idea and I'm trying to follow my inspiration and go with where it feels like it wants to go. That's the best way I can put it. It feels like there's a natural will behind the music and I'm trying to obey it and follow it. And in doing that, I frequently get to points where I don't have the skills to do what I'm being given. Right, what I'm receiving. I don't have the skills. So then I have to go, right, I need to develop those skills. And then I go, then I'll sit there and that'll become part of my practice. I'll work very, very hard on getting those skills. Then a year later, I'm in the same position, then I can do it. So the practice I'm doing is basically working on all the points I find in my free improvisation where I don't have the skill to do it.
Mm.
And that's how it progresses.
So walk us through like a day in the life, because we can link people to your music afterwards, and it's in, like, incredible piano playing. It's like unbelievable. I mean, I remember the first time I sat with you properly in Portugal on a retreat, and it was a continuous om night, which was, you know, it's a bombardment on the senses. It's a horrible evening of over the
it's
top.
It's awesome. It's not horrible.
Well, no, absolutely,
it's wicked.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. But at the same time, like, it's an ordeal to go through in some way. And then
a beautiful ordeal.
Yeah.
Right, quick interjection to explain what a continuous om is, because we didn't explain it. So the idea behind a continuous om is that you have to make sound with every out-breath. So it doesn't matter what it is, but with every in-breath and every out-breath, you make a noise. And the original continuous oms were done in the United States, and they were just omming for 12 hours throughout the whole night. So om, 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 and on and on and on it went. Or om and om and om it went. And people came out of this and they felt absolutely incredible. All their cells felt revitalized and they had all these breakthrough experiences. So it was then exported all around the world and people did variations of it in their own ceremonies. So the particular one that I'm talking about with Eddie, we started off doing about half an hour or 45 minutes of omming. And then after that, you were then allowed to make any sound that you liked, but you had to make a noise with every breath. And you can't really imagine how crazy this thing was. 20 people in a retreat center in Portugal, howling, making dog sounds, cat sounds, and screaming and chanting and all these other things. And it was completely crazy. It was literally like being in a full-blown madhouse. And you also have this crazy thing happen to you that because you're continually making noise, you're vibrating through your chest cavity and it vibrates your cells and it vibrates down your arms and it vibrates down your fingers. And eventually you have this sort of cosmic pins and needles in your fingers and it feels like you can't feel your hands. But actually, it's because you've been vibrating yourself so much that all your body is vibrating. You're like an enormous tuning fork. It's a very psychedelic experience. And at that time, I'm under the influence of ayahuasca and I had a crazy noise in my ear that was this interdimensional chit chat that kind of goes like this. So I had all that going on in my ears, and then including everybody making all their crazy noises, and then this giant mandala that was swirling and twirling in front of my face, and then I'm also making all these weird noises. And at some point I completely lost control of what I could hear, what I could see, and the noises that I was making as well. So vision's gone, sound's gone, and my ability to control my own sound has also gone. And it was such an overload for my brain, I actually felt the cognitive part of my brain switch off, the decision-making part, or the bit that kind of protects the ego. It actually just turned clean off and said, I can't cope with this anymore because there's too much, it's too much sensory input and it's overloaded me. And I was left with nothing. I was just like running on pure instinct. I didn't have that like thinky, nice little monkey thinking brain that you usually have. And I completely lost my shit. And I ended up having, I would describe, as a controlled, full-blown mental breakdown over the course of about an hour or so. So that's why when I say it was an ordeal, it was, for me, actually a bit of an ordeal. But that's no reflection on the continuous om. The continuous om is actually a very beautiful process of healing your body with sound. Anyway, back to me and Eddie in the van.
Beautiful ordeal.
Beautiful ordeal. Yeah. And then there's like a downtime where you get some peace for an hour after these like 5 or 6 hours of just craziness. And then the silence broke with you playing the piano. And you got on this like, I don't know, 45-minute journey. And I remember afterwards, I was like, you know, it was amazing. And I was like, what was it? And you were like, oh, yeah, well, it was a bit of my own stuff, a bit of Beethoven, a bit of Bach, and it was like 5 other things. It was like a piano remix Eddie special. But to get to that point, talk us through, like, your daily routine of piano playing.
My daily routine of piano playing? I don't have so much a daily routine. Like, I practice on average 3 hours a day. But some days it'll be 4 or 5, some days it'll be 1 or 2. And it depends and it fits in with the rest of my life. You know, if I've got a whole Saturday with nothing else to do, I might well do, like, 7 or 8 hours in that day. But I might go Friday, Saturday, Sunday without doing any practice because I'm away in Glastonbury or something like that. So I don't have a consistency, but I generally practice about 3 hours a day. And in that practice time, the principal things I'm working on is putting together more and more polytempo tools and more modal tools. So I've got a richer menu of modes to be able to call upon, and I've got a bigger selection of polytempo patterns. For example, at the moment, I'm working with 24 particular polytempos, 24 particular combinations of speeds, and out of those 24, about 16 are good and the other 8 are iffy. So once they're all good, then I've reached a particular level that I can then build on and go further from there, you know. And with the modes, out of the 96 modes that I've made for my mode chart, there's about, you know, 30 that I'm particularly interested in nailing and learning. Having, you know, having a look at them all, the 96, and laid them all out in front of me, there's about 30 or 30 so that I particularly are going to be useful for me. They're going to help me or give me the tools to express what is likely to come.
So I've seen the mode board is the randomization board. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it depends what you mean by randomization. I mean, the mode board allows me to use dice to randomize that element of my practice. So I can roll a dice to pick a particular mode, thus randomizing my mode. I can roll a dice to pick my key, thus randomizing my key. But it's random within particular constraints. So they're not really random because all the modes are very rigorously mathematically worked out.
And the purpose of that is to keep it interesting for yourself or to keep adding an element of randomness?
Well, it's also a case of just recognizing that myself included, most people that play a musical instrument, tend, particularly when improvising, tend to fall into doing the same thing. They fall into the same patterns, you know. The classic examples, you'll get a blues guitarist. And, you know, and they'll go, oh, I just play what I feel. I don't want to learn scales and modes. I just play what I feel. And in them playing what they feel, they play for their entire lives just an Aeolian and a blues scale. Like Aeolian chords and a blues scale.
Hello, me again. So at this point, I thought I'd give you a little interruption and tell you what an Aeolian chord and a blues scale was to give it some frame of reference. Well, that was until I went and found out what it was myself, which meant I had to go and watch lots of middle-aged men in their basements rocking out on guitars, and they explained me all about it, which took several hours, and I came to the conclusion that there isn't really a very simple way of getting that across without spending several hours watching middle-aged men in their basements rocking out on guitars. So this interruption didn't really work out, and I haven't really told you what Aeolian chords and blues scales are. Never mind. Back to Eddie in the van.
Because that's all they're gonna feel if there aren't any new things, you know, put in place. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's just a kind of case of the more modes I've got put in place that I know and intuitively, instinctively know, the more there's this open space inwardly for inspiration to flow into.
philosophically in pushing the boundaries of polytempos and making this more complicated music that is initially, you know, is overwhelming for the layman's ear.
Like, well, it shouldn't be. I mean, if I've done my job well, and I might not necessarily have done it as well as I'm going to do it yet, but I feel if I've done my job well, then the music should be like a tree or like a sunset or something, in that it's initially beautiful and simple. But if you want to look into it in depth and you want to sit and contemplate it deeply, then you will see more and more levels of depth. You'll see more and more levels of involvement, more and more levels of ratios and mathematical patterns. But for it to be a success, in my mind, it should be appreciable. Is that a word? Appreciable?
It can be.
Appreciable on an immediate level, all the way up to a very, very considered deep level. And, you know, so there's like fractal levels of appreciation that are possible. That's what I'm aiming for. Which is why it's useful to have mode systems which kind of guarantee a certain harmonic unity, even though they're harmonically different and alien. If I use an obscure mode, it will sound weird and different, whatever, but there'll be a certain harmonic unity which makes it accessible, or, you know, slightly accessible, rather than just a complete atonal Schoenberg-esque mess.
I like that you say things like that, like I would know what it means. It's great.
Yeah.
So the polyrhythm, the polytempo, and it's like increasing the ability for people to listen to it, or pushing the boundaries of what people can listen to.
Well, not just listen to, but actually all the senses. I would hope that it points towards an expansion of all the senses. For example, you know, when you're really present in your body and you're really in the center, in your heart, you can feel all of your physical sensations. You can feel all of your emotions. You're aware of some thoughts floating in and out. You're aware of the smells in the room. You're aware of the sounds coming in. You're aware of the visions. You're aware of all these things simultaneously. There's this kind of like multi-experience, which is the kind of characteristic feature of the present consciousness, you know? That's what we all want, you know, to be present and in this now, because in this now is deeply rich and beautiful and multifaceted. Whereas when you're in the mind, it's a bit two-dimensional, it's a bit flat, you know, you're like in a flat world when you're thinking. But when you're present, you're in this multi-dimensional world. So I feel like a multi-dimensional music makes that demand of the listener for them to be able to listen to four or five things at the same time, and that is encouraging the brain to do that same thing, to have its awareness in several different places. Which I think should be the right kind of stretch to improve one's general consciousness from day to day. I mean, I've found myself that listening to stuff like Wagner or really, really great music has increased my capacity to be able to appreciate the sounds of nature. So when I go out for a walk now, I feel I can hear the birds and the cars and the wind at the same time and take it all in. Whereas before I had pushed my listening with these great composers, I perhaps would not have been able to take so much in. And I feel like if art can do that, if one great goal of art is to stretch the capacity, to stretch the consciousness of the listener, I think all great art aspires to do that, you know, to improve the consciousness of the listener. I think that's really the golden goal of art. That's the goal of art with a capital A.
So I like that a lot. And the expanding the consciousness generally. Now, I know you've talked about it before, and it was something that it greatly interests me. But morphic resonance and those fields, and a quick intro into morphic resonance, in case you're listening to this and you haven't heard of it. The idea there is a shared information field for species, which is the reason why all monkeys are afraid of snakes, even if they've never seen them.
Yeah.
And you can train rats to do certain things, and then other rats on the other side of the world that have never seen the experiment can then do that without having seen it. And one of my favourite ones was when they first introduced cattle grids on the floors, cows always used to get stuck in them. And then on the other side of the world, even though cows had never seen them before, they didn't actually have to install cattle grids. They just painted lines on the floor and the cows were inherently afraid of them. So that idea of like building things into the morphic resonance field, which I'm totally on board with, and what you're doing with the polyrhythms, what do you think in your own mind?
Oh, there's so much to think about that. Just trying my thoughts in order. I mean, like, I think Rupert Sheldrake is amazing, by the way. Rupert Sheldrake is the guy that came up with the concept of morphogenic fields. He's a brilliant, open-minded, honest scientist that I think gets a really bad rap from the scientific establishment that try and paint him as some kind of kook.
Yeah.
He's actually a really brilliant scientist.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
And the morphic resonance idea is really interesting. And I'm not saying that it's definitely correct, but I think that a lot of the ideas within it are probably to a certain extent correct. Or I think at least the morphic resonance idea is in the direction of something that's correct, you know?
Well, to me, it doesn't really make any sense that nature is this unbelievably fantastic machine that can build humans and all these things and ecosystems and things that link to other things and these symbiotic relationships and all these amazing things come out of it. And then the idea that it just forgot to put in a database or a memory.
Well, yeah, what's also really interesting is what information is in nature. I mean, when you actually look at physical nature, you're looking at atoms and you're looking at electrons and photons. Like, where is information? What is information? Because clearly, like, the DNA in our cells contains an enormous amount of information, like a crazy, crazy amount of information. But ultimately, where is that coming from? Like, when you go right back to the beginning, how is this information coming about? So the idea of informational fields is a tricky and interesting idea. But I think that morphogenic fields, the idea of it, it's already happened in music because children born now can easily appreciate music like Mozart and Beethoven and Haydn, that kind of stuff, and appreciate the harmonies, and it just sounds normal to them. But in the 1200s, if you'd heard that kind of music, it would have made no sense at all because the brain wasn't used to those kind of harmonies. The only harmonies they were used to was open fifths, the basic da-da, like plain chant, Gregorian chant.
Hello, me again. I thought it might be nice to put that in context and listen to a little bit of Gregorian chant. So here it is. Feast your ears on this. Just lovely, isn't it? But I think we can all agree we're rather glad that music has moved on quite a bit since then. Okay, back to Eddie in the van.
Really, really basic harmony. Even a major third was considered dissonant in like the 1100s. So now, as over the years, more and more dissonant harmonies, more higher up the harmonic series, higher numbers in the harmonic series were used in music, everyone gets used to hearing that. And now we can all hear up to like, I don't know, the 32nd harmonic and it sounds right. But polytempo, we haven't got used to hearing that yet. Now, what I'm suggesting is that in the 20 years, 50 years, whatever, it will sound normal to be able. You'll be able to hear when you hear 5/3/2, you'll just be able to hear that there's three speeds there, and it'll be obvious that there's three speeds there. Rather than right now, if you heard 5/3/2, you would hear a texture of speeds, and you might just be able to make out that there are three speeds going on, but you probably wouldn't be able to distinguish what they were, or hear them very clearly. You know, so I think that the minds will develop along those lines, and the idea of morphic resonance, you know, might well be right.
I like it a lot. I mean, it resonates with me for sure. I like the idea of it, you know, humans being able to ever understand more complicated things. It feels like when you listen to classical music, and this is my interpretation of it, and I've been to a few like string quartets and stuff like that, that actually it was at some point super complicated. In fact, I struggled to follow a string quartet. I couldn't tell you what they played, but like it was an overwhelming amount of information for my brain to process. And then there's been this sort of dumbing down in pop music, which I feel like it does feel like it's dumbed down. I don't know. You can tell me. Maybe I'm right or wrong.
Pop music is like anti-music. It's not just dumbed down. It's going in the exact opposite direction. If real music is there to open up your mind and expand your consciousness, pop music is there to close it down. Pop music encourages things like greed and ego and insecurity and vanity and all of these things. That is what is encouraging in the listener.
I know you've got a fairly strong feeling about what happened with classical music. And
what do you mean?
Well, essentially that it reached a point, and I've heard you talk about it before, but where people are just re-recording the same pieces of classical music.
God, yeah. I mean, I have this quite a strong view. I feel sad that you've got pianists all over the world, the kind of the people that show the best potential, the people that are brilliant pianists. They get bundled off to the Juilliard and the Moscow Conservatoire and the Royal College, and they just get put through this almost like this sausage machine where they go and learn the Chopin etudes and the Liszt etudes and the Beethoven sonatas and Rachmaninoff concertos, and they come out and they go and play the same pieces which people have been playing for hundreds of years. So since Liszt and Chopin, when the pianist composers were playing new works, and that was what you'd go off to hear, for the last 100 years, almost every pianist has been playing works by other composers that died hundreds of years ago. Mm. There's very, you know, and there's a small amount of people playing original piano work, but I feel like it should be the majority of pianists should be playing their own work. You know, you wouldn't have a band like Radiohead releasing Sgt. Pepper 1 year and then releasing, I don't know, Led Zeppelin 3 the next year and then releasing Portishead the next year. They release their own music. But whereas in the classical music world, it's perfectly normal for someone to come out and release the Chopin Etudes, which has been released literally hundreds of times, Beethoven's Sonatas literally hundreds of times. And what's the point? Mm. It's a complete waste of your time. I think it's a shame.
It is a massive shame.
The whole classical music world has become like a museum industry where you go to a concert and you're going to hear 200-year-old music. I think that pianists should play a bit of Beethoven and should play a bit of Chopin, should play a bit of Bach. That should be a part of whatever, but it shouldn't be like your raison d'etre. Every pianist should be playing their own thing first and foremost, and that should be informed by their love of Bach, Beethoven, jazz, funk, and all the other styles which they hopefully will have at least dipped their toe in.
Mm. We should talk about what you're doing right now, really. So you are no joking. Seems like you're on the edge of being famous. You're lots of interviews going on, BBC, Sky News, all kinds of things. Go on, tell what happened with your Sky News interview.
Oh, I've been given a lot of these interviews, like radio interviews and Sky News interviews and something on the BBC. To be honest, I mean, I'm grateful for it. I'm grateful for the exposure and I'm grateful for what impression you've been doing. But on the other hand, it's also very, very tiresome because these interviews, they're all in the same kind of vein in that...
Like this one.
This is a bit better. Basically, our press guy has got a press release and he sends that press release off to the radio and to the TV and everything like that. And he's trying to make it so that they will take me on, right? So he needs to find this hook, right? And his hook has been the dice system. Now, the dice system is a very small part of what I do. It's an incidental part of what I do. It's like coming into this van and focusing just on the mugs and going, oh, it's your mug van, you know. You've got some mugs over there, but that's not like the basis of this van. So I've got this dice system, which I sometimes use to randomise the variables in my practice, the mode, the tempos, the key, and that kind of stuff. But I could totally do everything I'm doing without dice. It's just a fun way for me to just do something different each day. Anyway, all the media fixate on the dice. So every interview that I'm getting, it's all like, so, here Edward Chilvers, the dice man, blah, 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 blah. taking on a tradition from Mozart using dice. It's like nothing to do with Mozart's dice. It's absolutely nothing to do with Mozart at all. So it's trying to try and... I'm trying to answer their questions whilst also trying to be at least slightly what I'm actually talking about. Mm. Well, you know, it wants to be about the dice, and I really want to talk about the multidimensional aspect, the aspect of consciousness, what I'm trying to do in that kind of way, but they don't want to hear that. They want to hear, like... Even on Sky News, the woman said to me, have you got any tips for... my friend's daughter is doing grade 5. I'm like, bloody hell, what kind of... We've got 5 minutes for this interview. You could ask me so many things and you're asking me just stupid questions like that. I despair sometimes. The Bristol radio interview was good. The guy that interviewed me in Bristol radio, he seemed a bit more interested in talking about deeper things, but yeah. Most of them have been a bit formulaic, predictable.
Bristol, good people, see?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
But anyway, so the hubbub around you is because...
There's an album coming out in March.
There we go.
Okay, so there's an album coming out. The EP is just out recently, and that's 5 tracks from the album, each of which are also singles. And there's also a film of the 31 pieces and a film of 11 of the 31 pieces. For these various reasons, it's all down to, like, the promoter has got this whole idea, this whole plan of what we need to do. Because I just had a 31 pieces record and a 31 pieces film. And what she said was, oh, you need to have an EP, you know, the launch campaign for that, and then the singles, blah, 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 and there's this whole plan. And the idea is that because we've had the EP and because we've had the singles, it's going to be easier for them to then get much more media attention for the album when it comes out.
Mm.
So the album comes out in March. It's 31 pieces. I'm really pleased with it. It's the best thing I've done so far in my life, musically. And it's basically, it contains all of the tools that I'm trying to pioneer, all the tools that I would like to catch on. It's all the tracks... in there don't have beginnings or endings. They all fade in and fade out to give the impression of them always going on. They all work in loops. All the tracks work in loops. They all come back around to the same place. So they essentially go on forever. But you as the listener come in and out for each track. That's the idea. So all the tracks go on forever. There's a symmetry to the structure of it in that I've got 16 polyrhythmic tracks, polytempo tracks, 8 free time tracks, 4 qubit tracks, 2 slowdown tracks, and 1 harmonic track. Harmonics, using harmonics on the piano. And they're arranged in a kind of triangular symmetrical form so that every other one is polytempo, every fourth one is free time, every eighth one is QB, and so on. So there's a nice kind of natural symmetrical structure to the record, which has caused us to have to put it on 3 CDs rather than 2, even though it would fit on 2. It needs to go on 3 because you can break the record up into 3 distinct CDs where each one makes sense on its own because of the fractal symmetry of the structure of the record.
It sounds like a puzzle. Sounds like a musical.
If you listen to it,
musical puzzle for the mind.
You would not have to understand anything. You wouldn't have to understand anything of the symmetry of the structure. You wouldn't have to understand anything of the multi-tempos, anything like that. If you just listen to it and you really properly listen to it,
yeah,
from beginning to end, then it should be a really cohesive journey that kind of that fits well together.
And your advice as a little, what's the serving suggestion
right,
for this?
Right. First of all, turn your fucking phone off. First of all, turn your phone off. Make sure it's off, right? Then make sure you've got 2 hours. The record's about 2 hours. It's what, maybe 1 hour 40, 1 hour 50. It's nearly 2 hours.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that you can listen to it for the whole 2 hours. You're not going to be disturbed. And put some candles on, turn the lights off, listen to it on a good stereo. That is my serving suggestion. Mm. I would much rather just everybody listen to it properly once than had it on in the background 20 times or had it on their car 20 times or had it on whatever 20 times. Just if you could just listen to it once and properly listen to it, I would be very, very happy. Because I think if you listen to it all the way through, by the time you get to the last bit, which is my favourite bit of the whole record, the very end, it's pretty blissful and transcendent.
You know what? I love it. No one, almost nobody is going to take that advice.
Well, why not? The thing is, right, people will sit, gladly turn their phone off and sit down and watch a film, right?
Yeah.
Why not do that with a piece of music?
I know.
Yeah, well, how many people have listened to Beethoven's Ninth Symphony from beginning to end? It's mad that you can hear it. Do you know, Beethoven never heard the Ninth Symphony. He never heard it because he wrote it when he was deaf. Right? He's never heard it. People in his day would be very lucky to hear it once, twice in their lifetime. People like Wagner will have heard the Beethoven Symphony probably only when he conducted it, you know? And now anybody can listen to the entire Beethoven Symphony, as many different recordings as they want, whenever they want. Do they? No. Right? It's this incredible life experience, this beautiful, profound life experience you can have listening to the Ninth Symphony. We went to listen to the Mozart Requiem, didn't we?
We did.
It's absolutely beautiful and profound, Mozart Requiem. Anyone can listen to a recording of that. Who listening to this has sat down and listened to the Mozart Requiem through? You really should. It's really, really brilliant. And yeah, everyone's seen, I don't know, E.T. or Star Wars or Return of the Jedi or Empire. I don't know.
Let's stay on the rant. It's good. Why should everyone listen to Mozart's Requiem?
Well, Mozart's Requiem is, in my opinion, the greatest thing that Mozart wrote. And Mozart's a pretty special composer. The Mozart Requiem is deep and profound and transcendent. He wrote it on his deathbed. He wrote it literally while he was dying. In fact, a lot of the composers excel themselves with their requiems. The Fauré Requiem, the Verdi Requiem, the John Tavener Requiem are all absolutely stunning.
I thought he didn't finish it.
No, he didn't finish it. Salieri finished it.
Yeah.
But because of the way that Mozart writes, Mozart's writing is so neat and mathematical and structured and formulaic that he's probably the easiest thing to finish and right. Also the easiest thing for AI to imitate. Mm. You can get an AI computer can make completely convincing Mozart compositions, but they would never be able to make a convincing Wagner. Well, I say never. I think they're a long way from being able to write a convincing Wagner opera, but AI can already do Mozart to a T.
Wow.
The Mozart Requiem, the Beethoven Ninth Symphony, the Shostakovich Tenth Symphony, the certain epic works in history that are just absolutely stunning. And I personally feel, as a human, immensely privileged to be in a reality where the Ninth Symphony exists for me to listen to and the Ring of the Nibelung exists for me to listen to. I just feel like, I feel sometimes just overwhelmed to the point of tears that I can just put on the Ninth Symphony. I can just put on the Bach's St. Matthew Passion or the B minor Mass.
Hello, me again. So Eddie just reeled off a number of classics that you should listen to. Now, there's an awful lot of classical music out there, and most of us are never going to listen to most of it. But it does feel a little bit like if you're going to sit with a musical genius and he's going to tell you that these are the 5 or 6 that you should really go out of your way to listen to. Well, it kind of feels like that's what you should do. It's a bit like now that's what I call classical music hits. So I've made a note of them, Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, Mozart's Requiem, etc. And I've put them in the show notes so you can have a little look at them later if you like. Okay, back to me in the van.
We're a lucky bunch of fuckers, really. We live in an age of just unbelievable. I mean, I know you hate a phone, But the phone is a good example of any piece of information you want immediately.
We tend not to appreciate it, do we? Because right now, like with Spotify, I don't use Spotify. I'm on Spotify. All my music's on Spotify. And I'm literally employing someone to try and get me on other playlists and streams and all that stuff. But I don't go on Spotify myself. I don't like music to be so easily available and cheap and disposable. I like to buy a vinyl and sit down and listen to it. Light a candle, put it on and listen to the whole vinyl all the way through. Not kind of have some music on in the background and then turn it off and put some other music on and not really be listening to it and not really care. So when you have music that becomes easier and easier to have, I think you lose something. You lose an appreciation of it.
I love your passion. In fact, it was your talking to you at a festival in the field about your passion about Mozart's Requiem. I was like, all right then, let's do it.
That was a very special night. And for anybody listening, that was a very special night. And I'm very grateful that I was there with you, because we got to the Mozart Requiem. We left enough time for the queue for the proms, because you've got a queue for the proms. And when we got to the front of the queue, we were told we couldn't come in because they'd sold loads of the tickets in pre-booking, internet booking tickets. And I was so angry, I could have just literally burnt the Albert Hall down. So we wandered around the Albert Hall trying to sneak in. And eventually we found an opportunity. Stephen went for it and snuck in, and we followed him, and we snuck into the Mozart Requiem. And it was really exciting, because we got, are we in, are we going to get away with it? We've got away with it. And then we went to the Mozart Requiem. So that was one of the most exciting proms I've been to. And we saved ourselves £6 each as well, which is jokes on them.
There was a couple of classic moments. That the best one was when the guy announces that there's hundreds of people who've been fucked over by this ticket thing, and they're all people who go to the proms every year. They know if they queue and they get a ticket, they get in, and then this year they get fucked over because the internet pre-booking, blah blah blah. And there's literally hundreds of people, like, red-faced and angry. And Eddie just turns and looks at the sky with his fists and just went, fucking internet! I'll never forget it.
But we didn't give up, did we? All those other people that didn't get in, they were like, oh, well, we didn't get in, we're going home. But we were like, no, we are going to the Mozart Requiem, whatever it takes. If I have to literally climb up the side of the Albert Hall and break into a window, I'm going to see the Mozart Requiem tonight.
We
snuck in, and it was wicked.
It was the highest level of middle-class crime I think you can possibly get, breaking into the Royal Albert Hall to go and see that. But yeah, you have a passion about music, and it draws people in. And actually, it's funny you should talk about how you should listen to music, because I've only ever listened to your other album, which is called, I want to say, 12 Etudes.
That's it.
Yeah. I only listened to that once before, and I thought, I should listen to it again. So I actually listened to it when I was driving over, twice as it happens, while I was coming here.
Right.
And I thought to myself, as I was listening to it in the car, I was like, he'll hate that I'm listening to this in the car.
No, I hate it. How good your car stereo is. Yeah. Maybe you've got a really quality car stereo and you can really hear all the intricate little bits in it.
Yeah, I'm definitely not present while I'm merging and taking exit slip roads, though, am I? Let's be honest.
Yeah, I mean, actually, if the music's doing what I want it to do, maybe it's not a good idea to listen to it in the car, because, you know, I'd want it to absorb you completely, and then maybe you'd crash your car and die, and that's the last thing we want.
Yeah.
So maybe I should put a warning stick on it. Do not listen to it in your car, because you might crash.
If you crash and die, that's what I wanted.
It's not what I wanted at all.
You were in the zone.
But I'm glad you're listening to my CD anyway. That's good.
It's actually, I really enjoyed it. There was a particular track which, you know what? I can't quite remember the name of it right now.
Can you hum a bit?
No. Well, let me tell you exactly which one it is, because it's worth it while we're on this conversation. I can actually use the dreaded phone, but... Discreet, undifferentiated.
Another little interruption from me again. I actually thought it might be quite nice to hear the song that we're talking about. So, here it is. Thank you.
So anybody listening to this, if you want to listen to the 12 Etudes, I think they're online somewhere. You can probably just like, if you search my name and 12 Etudes, then you'll find it. I know it's definitely on Spotify and probably other places as well.
And you got other music out there as well. It's not just you playing a piano.
Yeah, but the piano music is my proper music. The other music I've got out there is really just for kind of like my friends and the medicine community. I wouldn't want to kind of put that out there as my music. That's kind of like, underground. I want to keep that underground. I don't want that to be well known. You know, that's why I use a different name for it. Mm. So my medicine songs are really just for the people that come to medicine ceremonies.
Okay.
And then it's not to be widely known. If people want to listen to it, they can. But I'm certainly not going to publish it, put that there. On my website, I don't mention it. I don't mention any of that stuff on my main website. It's not mentioned on the Facebook. It's not mentioned in anything that I'm doing with the serious music, because I don't want to muddy that. Mm. I think it's like, because I think that the songs, they're okay. They do the job that I want them to do, which is they get a particular message across. But musically, they're nothing special or unique or different. They're very standard, obvious chords, obvious songs, obvious melody. They're simple. Mm. So I don't really want to kind of associate that with my serious music.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
So back to your album then, and the serving suggestion, which is present in the room, candles, decent stereo, do the whole thing, three CDs and...
Well, it's three CDs if you've got a CD player. If you listen to it on a computer, you can just listen to the whole thing through in one go, which is probably better. I mean, I hate to say it, because I mean, I would much rather myself listen to things on vinyl and CDs. But because the work is an hour and 50 long and there are no gaps at any point because every track blends into every other track, it is better if you listen to the whole thing in one go somehow. Mm. So this pros and cons to it. You know, on a vinyl, you're going to get that lovely warm vinyl sound. On a CD, you get that lovely clear CD sound, but on a computer, you can get it through as the work is intended.
Is there a particular motif for each song? What's the journey that the person's going through? Or what was the intention behind it?
That's a difficult question to answer. Really. Each track has got a particular kind of like musical DNA to it, and then it's free to grow and evolve differently every time it's played. So, for example, the first track, the principal riff is a triplet riff that happens at four different speeds in D minor. So it happens at a speed of 7 to 5 to 3 to 2, but it's a simple triplet riff. So that's the same every time. And then it develops into a middle section that has other mathematical rules, which you can improvise around, and then it comes back to the original riff. And all of the pieces have this kind of this orbit where they go through a particular structure and return to the start point again. But there's a lot of freedom within the constraints. You might have a constraint of a polyrhythmic pattern, a modal pattern, and a phase pattern. But then within those constraints, it can be very, very free. In the same way that in a blues, you say, right, we're going to have a 12-bar blues and a blues scale, right? That's the same every time. Every 12-bar blues is basically a 12-bar blues and a blues scale, but it's different every time because you do different things with the blues scale every time. You do different inversions of the 12 bars chords, you know? Mm. You might do different things with a beat. So it's like that, really. It's kind of got the improvisational feel of jazz, but there's a lot more variables because we've got modal variables, polytempo variables, phasing variables, and some other variables that are harder to describe. But it's free within that. And what I wanted the music to be was to be like alive, because one of my big criticisms of classical music and music in general is that all these pieces are the same every time. They're not alive to grow. And I think ideally a piece of music should be different every time you perform it, for me anyway. It wants to be different every time. It wants to be alive and of the moment, not just static like a statue, like most of the classical music world is now. Every time you go and hear a Chopin etude, it's the same every time.
Do you say you want it to be different every time you perform it, and I imagine you probably go out of your way to do that if it's live.
I don't go out of my way, that's how it naturally happens.
So when you go to do the actual recording, though, is the recording just a version in time?
And that's why the 31 pieces CD is different to the 31 pieces film, because the filmmaker and the engineer took different cuts from the session. So in the recording session, I played each of the 31 pieces through maybe 6 or 7 times. Mm. And then the engineer went through all that and he picked his favourite cuts from all those. And the filmmaker went through and he picked his favourite cuts. So that some of them are the same cuts and some of them are different. And when I play it live, they'll be different again.
Ah.
So it's very much fundamental to the nature of the work that it's different every time you hear it. There's a few key principles to it. One is that none of them have beginnings or endings. One of these is my fundamental thing that they're multi-tempo. One is that they are a variety of different modal systems. And one of them is that they're different every time they're played. And these are kind of some of the main musical ideas that I hope permeate musical culture.
So you're an amazing musician. Give us a list of the other instruments you play, just on top of the piano, just for those who don't know.
I'm I play drums. That's my second study after piano. So I play kit drums. And my kit's up in a particular way. It's not a standard kit, but it's set up to do multi-tempo beats. So multi-tempo is my... I'm trying to do some new things on the drums as well. I actually had, you know, Ravi?
Yeah.
I had Ravi round on Monday, and we did some recordings with drums and electric kora, which is really cool.
Nice.
So, yeah, drums is my second study. And Bwiti harp, I play quite a lot. I also, I'm sort of like good amateur level on guitar. So I know my way around the guitar. I can play the basic things on guitar well enough to play songs and just doodle around a bit with a delay pedal, you know? And I play bass a bit, sort of well enough to play in a sort of a punk band or something.
I like that you say that, because you're fucking amazing on the guitar. So the idea that's like your third or fourth discipline or something is ridiculous. So where do you see what you do? Because a lot, it's amazing stuff, the polyrhythm and you and the piano. But where do you see that fitting in with like a wider music community or working with people? Because is it always going to be a single solo man project?
No. And this is one thing I'm really hoping if the work can take off a little bit, I would like to do more collaborations. But it's really hard to find people I can collaborate with because it's quite difficult to do. So it's nice to collaborate with Ravi because he's a really high level musician and he's kind of get what I'm doing and we can jam with stuff. And I've got a drummer coming around in January who I've worked with before, and he's interested in some of the polytempo stuff. But anybody that's interested in doing multi-tempo stuff, modal stuff, and any of these other ideas, I'd like to work with. But it's really hard to find somebody that A, is interested in doing it, and B, is capable of doing it. So hopefully, in the next couple of years, as this music gets out a bit, I will meet some people that I can collaborate with more. But it's got a lot of legs, you know. You could definitely do these polytempo styles. You could do them with funk. It's already been done with metal to a certain extent. You can do them with any style, really. I'd like to get some really good jazz musicians around, or some really good jazz drummers that are interested in doing it. But I'm hoping that in, say, 20 years' time, a lot of these skills will start to become the normal skills that you would learn. A lot of the time, already now, if you go to an electric guitar lesson, you'll be learning a lot of skills which didn't exist 20 years ago, because electric guitarists are constantly innovating what is possible on the guitar. Right. That doesn't really happen with the piano. The piano technique hasn't really progressed since Liszt, maybe a little bit of Rachmaninoff. There's a few kind of interesting things happened in the 20th century with the Debussy etudes and the Ligeti etudes, but they're not really like new foundations for piano technique. They're more some obscure tangents of piano technique where you're learning to do some peculiar things that don't really have a lot of application. So the fundamental piano technique hasn't really come on much since Liszt. In like, you know, 1880 or something.
Is there anybody else doing it at your level on the piano?
Doing multi-tempo stuff?
Yeah.
I don't think there's anybody doing it at all, as far as I'm aware.
Yeah, right.
When I've Googled or YouTubed polyrhythmic piano or polytempo piano or anything like that, no, basically, no. There isn't anybody else doing what I'm doing. But I think that there will be once people see that it's possible. So when I first started doing it and I had the idea of doing it, I didn't know if it was possible. And when I first started to do it, it felt like this, I'll never be able to do this, this is impossible. But I was determined. I thought like, no, I really feel strongly. This is what I want to do. So I persevered and found that it was possible. And as time goes on, a lot of things that I thought were impossible, I realise are possible. And so I think, it should catch on. People realise it's possible. They'll realise how much you can do with it, and then they'll want to do it. And then we can all progress.
Hello. Me again. Interruption again. This is quintessentially why I love this man. It's insane to me to think that when he started on this polyrhythmic journey, it wasn't known if it was humanly possible to play what he was envisioning with his mind. He's quite literally a musical visionary, that he has imagined something in his mind that's never been done before, and spent years, literally years, getting to the point where he could actually play it. Absolutely astounding. Anyway, back to the van.
So where do we all progress to? What is your... I know you want to build like a music temple. Yes. I would describe it as...
That's the goal. Yeah, well, Ben Kapp and I, my engineer, both of us, we want to try and pool our money, pool our property and buy a property to build a music temple. And the music temple, as we envision it, would be like a hub where we would do, you know, all kinds of lovely things that are connected to the flowering of consciousness. So there would be Tai Chi weekends and yoga weekends and medicine ceremonies and, you know, permaculture and all that kind of stuff. But it'd be centered around the idea of music. Mm. And I would hope to create an environment and a place that would attract the elite musicians from around the world. Because what in my soul, deeply, what I most want to be doing with my life is jamming with and composing with and collaborating with really brilliant musicians on a daily basis. You know, spend my life just jamming with brilliant musicians, because that's what gets me the most joy. I love it. I love doing that.
Mm.
So live in a music temple with brilliant musicians, have concerts regularly, have pupils come to learn there. It'd be like a kind of music school / ashram / community center. Yeah. That's how I envision it. With the ideal possible music performance space.
I feel like a lot of people want this.
Yes, they do.
A version of this.
Yeah, we just need to find funding. It's all about funding. Which is another thing, which if the work takes off a bit more, I'm more likely to find a kind of rich backer. Otherwise we've got to rely on our own.
Well, I wonder, yeah. Because people generally want the same thing. I mean, it might not necessarily... Some people might prefer that it was focused on yoga. Some people might prefer that it's focused on the Tai Chi or the whatever. But the fundamentals are the same. There's a central hall. There's a room.
This is what we all want.
This is what we all want. And then there's a bit of land and then you live in it. It's like...
And people with money do it. You know, but the thing is, not many of us have £1 million lying about. And £1 million is to start with, you know. For the music temple as we envision it, it's going to be a couple of million... really, to build it and to make it.
Well, so I wonder about this, because probably we could all make it happen if we were really committed. Like, you know, if I sold my half my flat that I've got in London, and you've got your house, and Ben's got a house.
Got a flat, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, everybody's involved in all these things, actually sort of committed to.
That's what we're trying to do at the moment.
As a project.
At the moment, me and Ben were saying, like, how can we work towards making this a thing? And there's lots of different... One way is by growing the YouTube channel, trying to grow a community there. One thing is by trying to grow, you know, get the work out there more in the world. But also, we're trying to find people and put together a group of people that can make it happen. Mm. If we can have 5 or 6 people together that own property, that have the same vision, and that we all trust each other, because that's such an important thing. When you get into money matters with friends, it's just a breeding ground for disagreement. So you've got to be like, make sure that everyone is entirely on the same page and everyone feels the same way and everyone's completely clear about what they're willing to do and what they're not willing to do. But I think we can definitely do that. We're all willing it. Enough people want to do it. I think it's going to happen. I really feel like the music temple will happen within the next 10 years. Hopefully within the next 5 years. We'll see.
I hope so. I believe so. I mean, it feels like probably if you're listening to this, you are in that community anyway.
Yeah.
You know what we're talking about, the medicine type community, all those people, you know, it's all the same thing, all the people wanting the same thing. And
if you're listening to this and you have a property and you'd like to sell your property in order to become part of a magical musical community, then, you know, let us know.
Or if you've just got a spare £1 million and
you've got a spare £1 million
and you're not really sure what to do with it,
yeah,
then definitely we could find a little home for it. But yeah, it feels like the right way to go. And there's a massive journey with the ashram, because, well, a lot of them didn't work out, did they? Let's be honest.
But we've got to learn from all the ones that didn't work out. I mean, all over the world, people have tried to start up these communities, because this is the way that we're going to evolve. We're not going to evolve by constant revolutions where we tear down the government and get some other government in. We're going to get there through fractal communities springing up around the world and gradually growing and connecting. And it's going to come from the ground upwards. So all over the world, there's people trying communities with different ethoses, permaculture communities and spiritual communities and medicine communities, and all of them are encountering problems and they're falling out and they're going wrong. And that is part of the evolutionary process. And when you start a community, you'd be wise to learn from as many mistakes of all the other communities as you can. And if everyone goes around trying to learn from the mistakes of the previous communities, what went wrong here, what went wrong there, why did that go wrong, then we can all learn and get better. Because already all these ideas are in play for communities. They're constantly improving and getting better, particularly permaculture. You know? There's better and better ideas all the time for living greener, healthier, better ways.
It's interesting because the COVID pandemic basically really brought it home. And I was away at the time, actually, but I thought it was all quite funny from a distance, because I was away in France at the time. I was like, ho, 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 there's people, you know, piling shopping, toilet roll fucking 10 feet high in their shopping trolleys and blah, blah. and thought it was all quite funny. And then when I came home, and then I went to the shop, and there wasn't any food. It was like there was no food in the supermarket. And it was, you think, obviously it just gets restocked because it's just a temporary thing that people are panic buying while the pandemic's on. But when we get to some of the more serious problems a little bit later on, when global warming starts to hit and crops are failing and those other things, it won't look like such a fucking shit idea that actually there's a bunch of you got out and started a little hippie community somewhere and you grew some of your own food. You know? Yeah. It's not going to seem like a crazy idea.
And you know, these things happen. Nothing in evolution has happened but by necessity. Nothing ever happens until there is a real prerogative for it to happen.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that is what is happening. There's more and more people like us that are going, oh my God, I don't want to be part of this world. I want to opt out. I don't want to be part of this whole system. And the only way that you can do that is to start your own system, start your own community and learn from all your mistakes.
Mm.
So that's what I think we plan to do. That's the dream. Wake up every day, do some yoga, do some meditation, and then jam with some of the best musicians in the world. That is my dream life for 8 months of the year, and then go touring for 4 months of the year.
I'll
go touring around, you know, Carnegie Hall and the Albert Hall and the great European cities. That's what I'd love to be doing.
Sounds all right. I can keep the IT lab going in the ashram, if you like.
We'll probably need some. I envision...
Run some cables.
I envision there being one room that has computers in, and that you go and use your phone in, and the rest of the place is like you don't have your phone around any more than you'd have, I don't know, a hardcore porno around, because it just brings the vibe down. I think when you're in ashram, Shekhan Ashram in Glastonbury, for example, you know, they don't want phones in there. And when you have got someone with a phone in there, you really feel the difference. You really feel there's this draw of attention towards the phone. You know.
Mm.
Yeah, or it also feels like there's an intrusion in the room, because when there's a phone in the room, of course, it's listening to what everybody's saying and storing that information and using it to sell you stuff. So it feels like there's this intrusive energy in the room. And I feel that when I'm having dinner with someone and they have their phone there, I feel intruded upon. I feel like I'm not alone with that person. I feel like there's this little window out to this other world that half of their attention is with, you know.
Mm.
So that'd be nice. A computer room. You know, if you need to use a computer... fine, just go and do it in the computer room. And come out, smudge yourself down, and go and stand by a tree for a bit.
The phone should be like hardcore porn. It'd be like...
No one wants to see it. No one wants to see it. I mean,
People like are coming into your room quickly and you're having to stuff it under the pillow like it was a filthy mag. You've just been caught.
Yeah, I think it is filthy, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I did a gig at this tree planting ceremony last year.
Mm.
It was around about this time in Coed Hills, you know?
Yeah, no, I've not been there, actually.
It's really nice, but I was playing a gig there, and Susie Rowe was playing there. She's really good. She plays a gig there. And when Susie Rowe was playing, there were several people in the audience that got their phones out and were filming her. And for me, watching, it totally, like, sucked some of the vibe out of the gig.
Mm.
And so when I was on after her, and I just said to everybody right at the beginning, right, if you want to take any pictures or take any films, just don't. Turn your phone off and put it away. Otherwise, I just can't be bothered to do this. So I played the gig. Everyone put their phones away. It was actually a really, really nice gig. The vibe was different.
Yeah.
So I think it really does make a difference to the vibe when phones are around. On the phones, right? Just to really nail the point home.
Go on.
You notice if you're around with a group of people, there's four of you hanging out, you're talking. If one person gets their phone out, like for some legitimate reason, you watch everybody else immediately get their phones out. Like it's like some kind of Pavlovian response. So one person gets their phone out and people just almost without thinking get their phone out, check their messages, check their tweets or whatever, you know. It's like such an ingrained condition. Anyway, I'll stop ranting about phones.
It does make me use mine less when I'm around you because I know how much you hate them. But I was at Shambhala about, I think it was... The last year that it was on...
The best festival
ever. And Brass Rave Unit. Have you ever seen them? Got those guys?
Are they the guys that walk around like with the brass and they're doing it in the bandstand? They're just, the little brass band.
It was 90s dance songs covered with a 12-piece brass.
I'm pretty sure I've seen them. And if I haven't seen them, I've definitely seen something like that.
It was un-fucking-real good. It was probably the... you know, is up there, one of the top.
And they're mobile, aren't they? They're marching around the festival. They're not stuck in one place.
No, no, no. They were on it. They were on a Chaiwala stage. They were. They were still. But there was about. I don't know if they move around or not, to be honest. But there was 12 of them on stage or something like that. It was fucking amazing. Obviously high as anything. Totally brilliant. And at one point, I was there with my mate Dale. You know Dale. And at one point, I looked around and the whole tent is going and going. And I went, what'd you notice? And he goes, what? And I went, no phones. Yeah. And there was not a single phone. And then I was, because Shambhala's pretty phoneless, actually. And then I started noticing. And it was like, we went to something else and it was going off. And I looked around and I was like, look, no phones.
Yeah. In stark contradistinction to Secret Garden Party, which might as well be called Secret Phone Party. I went to the last Secret Garden Party and it was the worst festival I've ever been to. It was just literally a sea of people constantly taking selfies and videos and filming everything on their phones.
That's like a very, I mean, it's, what was it? It's Huntingdon, which is like moneyed farmers area and lots of like, I mean, I went round there as a 35-year-old and I felt like some old troglodyte. What's that film where they kill you if you haven't made it by the time you're 30?
Yeah, I went to in that Secret Garden Party. I spent a lot of Secret Garden Party dancing outside the cheesy chips van, and I hate cheese, and I would never ever dream of eating cheesy chips, but this tiny little cheesy chips van had the most banging drum and bass playing like the whole time, and every other stage had this lame bland music that I just couldn't get on with. So I just kept on retreating to the cheesy chips tent and just, like, you know, have a little pipe and lose my nut dancing outside the cheesy chips tent. I was there for hours, you know. It's just brilliant.
Yeah, the Shambhala equivalent of that is the Ferris wheel. You ever know that? You ever noticed that?
I always go on the Ferris wheel. The Shambhala Ferris wheel, there's a perfect time to go on that. And that is at around about 6 p.m. on a Saturday, because that is when the fancy dress parade goes directly in front of the big wheel. So what you want to do is, preferably at the height of some psychedelic trip, right? You want to get on that Ferris wheel just as the parade is starting. And then you get to watch the whole fancy dress parade from... Oh, God, it's absolutely fantastic. And you get your little bits of different music as you're going round different points. When you're at the bottom of the wheel, you get the music from the big wheel. When you're at the top of the big wheel, you get the music from the main stage. Oh, the wheel at Shambhala is just fantastic.
I love the musical tips. Beethoven's Ninth, Mozart's Requiem, the big wheel at Shambhala.
The big wheel at Shambhala. The fairground rides at Boomtown.
We should tap into pieces of advice from you, because your life is music and you are so passionate about these things. So you've mentioned those things already, the ones we just listed. Mm-hmm. What are other musical things that people should go out of their way to listen to properly in the bath, candle, whatever setting that are...
Okay, well, J.S. Bach, first and foremost. I think I would suggest to everybody to listen to some Bach and not to expect to like it straight away, but it will grow on you. Bach is just the absolute foundation and roots of all Western music, and there's something very deep and profound about it. Almost as if it's not really a human that's written it. It has the quality of being almost discovered rather than composed. Mm. It's almost like some deep mathematical truth that's been unearthed. So yeah, Bach. Most of all, the Beethoven symphonies and the Mahler symphonies are really super epic, and the Shostakovich symphonies are really fantastic. If you want something, if you're not particularly into classical music yet, and you'd like something easily accessible, the Rachmaninoff piano concertos, particularly 2 and 3, are very accessible. That you can listen to the Rachmaninoff second piano concerto, and you'll probably like it straight away. Or the Rachmaninoff third piano concerto, you'll probably like it straight away. Right. So Rachmaninoff...
That's the spoon feed. So Rachmaninoff second, Rachmaninoff,
well, actually the Russian composers as well. Generally, Rachmaninoff is Russian. Tchaikovsky is Russian. So Tchaikovsky is very easy to listen to. You can listen to Swan Lake. You can listen to the 1812 Overture. You can listen to the Piano Concerto, the Violin Concerto, Capriccio Italien, Romeo and Juliet. And they're all instantly accessible. You'll get them straight away. Whereas the really, really great music like Bach, Wagner, Mahler, you're not going to get it straight away. It'll take work. It takes time to get to know. There's one composer that I think is really, really deeply good and you can get it straight away, and that's Debussy. So if you listen to Debussy, La Mer, which means the sea, that piece is extraordinarily beautiful and also miraculously instantly accessible. And I don't think I can say that about any other piece. Debussy's La Mer is kind of like a miracle. It's so deep so beautiful, so rich, and yet totally accessible. Mm-hmm. So if you can listen to one thing, Debussy's La Mer is a corker. And the Ravel's Daphne and Chloe, similarly, is just ravishingly beautiful and fairly accessible.
Not related to Daphne and Celeste.
No, not related to Daphne and Celeste. Is that a pop band or something like that?
U-G-L-Y, you ain't got no alibi because you ugly.
Oh, God, yes. It's slightly different from that.
Yeah.
But really, any famous classical composer, with a couple of exceptions, like Johann Strauss, which is just lame, with a couple of exceptions, is pretty much good. If they've stood the test of time, they're going to be good. If you listen to any famous classical composer that you've heard of, is probably going to be at least pretty good. Mm-hmm. I've got my particular favourites, but I would just find some time to sit and listen to it. Probably listen to it, because classical music, you need to listen to it to really get the juice out of it. Mm. Pop music, you can have it on the background, you hear a jingle that you recognise or a line, and that's pretty much what you get out of it. But classical music, there's layers, there's depth to it.
Mm.
And I think it's really worth putting time in and exploring it.
Do we dare talk about the ring?
No, let's not. Let's not. Let's not talk about the ring. I can't stop if I start talking about the ring. It'll be another 2 hours we'll be here. Also, I'd say about the ring is that...
Separate podcast all of a sudden.
The ring is one of the most inaccessible pieces of art in existence. You know, it's like, if you want to really appreciate the ring, it will take you months. It will take you months of hard work. And it could not be more worth it. It's the most worth it thing ever. You know, if anybody ever wants to really hear the greatest piece of music ever made, the greatest piece of art ever made, The Ring of the Nibelung is absolutely just beyond, you know. It's like there is a absolute chasm that separates Wagner's late works from all other compositions in music, you know. It's like, you know, the 100-meter sprint, and you've got the first person said, if Superman turned up for the 100-meter sprint, it would just be, you know, there's a chasm of difference. And that's what Wagner looked like. So I would really recommend Wagner's late works, i.e. Tristan, Mastersinger, Parsifal and The Ring, but they are not in any way accessible. They're not easy. No. They are absolutely the best thing ever.
I can vouch for that. We will, at some point in the future, I'm still convinced we can get you to walk people through, get rich people to pay a lot of money and for you to guide them through the ring by giving them an hour intro before each sitting.
I'd like to do that, yeah.
I reckon there's legs in that, because you walked me through it, and I'm the dumbest cunt going. So if you can walk me through four operas, then I think you're going to be all right with anyone else.
So there's classical music, and there's all these great composers in classical music, and I would say most of all Bach, Beethoven, Wagner, and then Mahler, Debussy, Shostakovich as my absolute favourites. Oh, and Monteverdi. There's also some other styles of music which are really, really well worth looking at. So in the jazz idiom, I think if you're going to pick one jazz guy, I would say Bill Evans is sophisticated and intellectual and deep jazz. It's really considered. It's not just like, you know, la-di-da jazz. It's really wicked, Bill Evans. So Bill Evans is great. Oscar Peterson's great. Art Tatum's great. It's worth looking into some of the old jazzers. Miles Davis, obviously. And then also in the electronica scene, there's some amazing electronica, but you've got to dig for it a little bit, because the electronica, which is in the mainstream, is generally very bland and lame. But if you look at, for example, the Warp label, the Warp is the record label, you've got Squarepusher, Boards of Canada, Aphex Twin, Myra Calyx, Brotham States, all these brilliant, brilliant electronica, Autica, all these brilliant electronica artists that are really doing something deep and interesting. And then there's a few other labels, like the Focus and VVM, that do underground electronica. If you dig for it, there's some wicked artists. So I would really recommend Squarepusher, Boards of Canada, Venetian Snares, Mike Paradinas, Autica. Did I say Autica already? Mara Calyx. These kind of guys. Really, really deep electronica. But to find the good electronica, you've really got to dig through the faff and the bland nonsense.
Yeah, Warp does a pretty good job, actually.
Warp is great.
I've generally enjoyed a lot of things that come out of Warp. I don't imagine they make a lot of money. They're a bit niche.
No, exactly. And then, so I'd say the exact same thing about world music. If you were to go into a record shop and just buy a world music record, chances are it'll be bland and boring. But if you really have a good sift through, there's some amazing world music. Principally, the Gabonese Bwiti music, first and foremost, and the Indian Raga music. So Gabonese Bwiti and Indian Raga music is amazing. The gamelan music is pretty cool. And then there's bits and bobs which you'll find around the world. It's worth digging for. World music. So yeah, classical music, electronic music, jazz music, world music. And then when it comes to metal, I think Meshuggah will do me. There's, for me personally, Meshuggah are just so good that I don't really ever find the time to listen to any other metal. I think Meshuggah are just unbelievably good. And I feel also about Radiohead are just such an incredibly good band that everybody should listen to Radiohead if they like good music.
Top tips all round. Wonderful. I'm gonna have to write all that down and list it out afterwards.
Right.
Top tip. Eddie's top tips, especially the order in which to spoon feed yourself classical music. In terms of some, what are your tunes to cut in? Is there something particular you'd like to be able to cut in of your own music?
Okay. Well, if I was cutting my own music, I would cut in some of the singles from the EP, because the EP came out. There's five singles on the EP, so the first one on there is the kind of the flagship track. So I'd probably have that one cut in.
Hello. Me again. Eddie's album, 31 Pieces, is actually out now, and it's available on all the usual platforms. But as requested, here's one of the singles that was released. It's called Exquisite Grief, and as the title suggests, it's not so upbeat.
Mr. Bungle is another brilliant band. Have you ever heard of Mr. Bungle?
No.
So Mr. Bungle's a real musos band. It's like the kind of band which all my friends who are professional musicians are like, oh my God, Mr. Bungle, you know Mr. Bungle? They're so good, but they're really very underground. You know, the lead singer, Mr. Bungle, was also the lead singer from Faith No More, but he only did Faith No More so that he could get his Mr. Bungle out there. But Mr. Bungle are a band of four virtuoso musicians who are all masters of like about eight different styles of music.
Wow.
And put them all together into this incredible sort of blender of styles. And they were a massive influence on me in my rock band days. Yeah, favourite bands. So Radiohead, Mr. Bungle, Led Zeppelin, Portishead, Wolfpack.
I like Wolfpack.
Wolfpack are super funky, just the funkiest. Oh my God, they're so funky. And they're also, Wolfpack are just so good at doing simplicity well. You know, not simplicity like Coldplay, where it's simple and incredibly boring and bland, but Wolfpack are so simple and yet so sophisticated and satisfying and awesome.
Well, so, they all play all the instruments in Wolfpack as well, don't they?
Pretty much.
They just swap around.
They swap around.
Yeah,
but they're just awesome.
Well, Mr. Chilvers, thank you for your time. Thank you for your musical insights. Thank you for your suggestions. Thank you for trying to convince people not to use their phones, or at least feeling guilty enough that when they're around you, they'll stop using their phones.
Just minimise your phone use. Don't stop using it. You know, just be aware of it a bit.
We'll link out to your YouTube page. I think you want to put people mainly towards that.
I would like people to subscribe to it and share all the videos all over the place. Yes.
You are on Instagram as Eddie Chilvers. You can follow you there.
I think it's Edward Chilvers Piano.
Edward Chilvers Piano.
I think it is. I think we had the idea that we needed to get the same name across all the platforms, so it ended up being Edward Chilvers Piano.
Okay. I can confirm Edward Chilvers Piano.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd like to add before we leave you?
No, I don't think so. I think that's great.
Great. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Lots of love, brother.
It's been fun.
And you want to finish off all those chocolates? You can take them.
No, I've already eaten more than my fair share of those chocolates, but it's made this interview much more enjoyable.
Fair enough.